Notice that what is happening here is that the poet is using his art to mend himself, and the poetry, which comes out of his mending process as an art, is a contribution to mending the world. What needs to be mended? A sense of history needs to be mended. A sense of personal history and a sense of the world's history. Not to reinstate time as it was before, but to revision what happened, what was of significance, to recast the shape of events in a new way, incorporating the hiatus as a part of the overall pattern, not as the end, but as a hiatus. It's a shift. It's the kind of shift that occurred about 100 AD. Up until about 90 AD, every time there was a very powerful vision in the world, it turned apocalyptic. The imagery of it became apocalyptic. You don't find any world vision up until about 90 AD, all the imagery tends to run to Judgment Day, Armageddon, extremes. In about 100 AD, you notice that there's a new precipitation of a new vision of the world that occurs and happens and comes in. You can see it by putting together, say, the opening page or so from the Book of Revelation and the opening page from the Hermetic treatise, the Poimandres. There's a world of difference. And in between them, a threshold has happened. It is now possible to have a world vision. Before then, everything ran to Armageddon-like extremes. So that Rilke now is able to mend a world because he can have a vision, because a vision is possible. How is it possible? Because what was seen as an end now is seen as a hiatus. What was the end of a world is now a transition to a new phase of the world. And it's just the experience that death is. Death, from a mythic standpoint, death is an end. Death is it. That's it. That's the period. But from a magical standpoint, death is a transition. It's not an end at all, but it's a transition. To what? To renewed life. From the wholeness of the vision, how can life die? Death is a transition. It's a passing over. It's not an end at all. So that's what's happening here in the poetry. And Rilke writes it this way. This is the third sonnet to Orpheus. A god can do it, but can a man expect to penetrate the narrow lyre and follow? His sense is discord. Temples for Apollo are not found where two heart ways intersect. For song is taught by you is not desire, not wooing of something finally attained. Song is existence. For the god unrestrained. And when shall we exist? And he require the earth and heavens to exist for us. It's more than being in love, boy, though your ringing voice may have flung your dumb mouth open thus. Learn to forget those fleeting ecstasies. Far other is the breath of real singing, an aimless breath, a stirring in the god, a breeze. Can you see the curious kind of shape to the vision which Rilke is having thrust on him? He's writing these poems almost every other hour at that kind of a rate. Day and night, he didn't sleep. Just took over. Ray Bradbury said one time in Berkeley a long time ago, we were talking about 2 or 3 in the morning at the Claremont Hotel, and he said, sometimes when I was young, he said, a story would grab me by the nape of the neck and drag me to the typewriter, and he said, I couldn't get up until I'd finished the story. Here's a translation from David Young of the same third sonnet to Orpheus. Let's see if it comes across in this. A god can do it, but tell me how a man can follow him through the narrow lyre. The human self is split. Where two heart ways cross, there is no temple to Apollo. Song, as you teach it, is not desire, not a wooing of something that's finally attained. Song is existence, easy for the god. But when do we exist? And when does he spend the earth and the stars on our being? When we love? That's what you think when you're young. Not so, though your voice forces open your mouth. Learn to forget how you sang. That fades. Real singing is a different kind of breath, a nothing breath, a ripple in the god, a wind. You get a sense of the power in the sonnets to Orpheus. Again, the reason why we're using it at this juncture is because the interface between art and history is a very peculiar kind of consciousness. When you come to a sense of self-attainment, the most difficult thing in the world is to give that up. The most difficult thing is not to think, well, I've done it. I've arrived. I'm here. In fact, the very mythic story, image of the impossibility of this is the myth of Sisyphus, that the great Albert Camus refreshed for us. Sisyphus, who is condemned by the gods because he considered himself to be as good as the gods, so the gods condemned him to the worst thing that they could think of for human beings, and that is endless, fruitless action. And it turned out that Sisyphus had to roll a huge stone, up to the top of this mountain. And every time he got it up to the top, it would roll back down. You'd have to go back down and do it again. You see, it's a mythic image of not being able to enjoy your achievement, not being able to have the triumph which you have worked hard for. I have to go and do it again. It's the same thing as like the karmic cycle of samsara. The naive think, oh, it's great, I'm going to have lots and lots of lives, but after 20,000 lives, oh shit, another life. How much pablum can you eat? How much anxiety can you take? Can you see the endless round? And so the realization that it's not about that at all. That's not what all this is about at all. What it's about is at the mysterious center of that whole cycle of activity, which isn't involved in this rim action at all. It's something completely different. So he writes it this way. This is the 10th sonnet to Orpheus. Welcome, whose meaning in me so long, coffins of stone, has been quietly growing. You, the Roman's gladdening water flowing through today as a wandering song. You also as open to all delight as awakening shepherd's eyes, full of stillness, and flowering nettle, and flight of delirious butterflies. Welcome to all who have snatched like this from doubt, the mouths re-endowed with power of speech after knowing what silence is. Knowing it or not, friends, which is our case, both alike has the lingering hour graved in the human face. I'll give you Young's translation of that. You've never been away from me, antique sarcophagi, but I greet you, you whom jubilant waters have flowed through since Roman days as wandering music. Or those old graves, wide open like the eyes of a shepherd who wakes feeling joyful, full of stillness and blossoming nettles, releasing a swarm of elated butterflies. All that we snatch away from doubt, I greet. Mouths that are open once more, having learned what silence means. Have we learned that? Or have we yet to learn? Both. Hesitating between what is, what gives our faces character. At least you can get the sense first through. I mean, you can buy these things for yourself, but you can see what's happening here. Rilke is on an interface. What is he on an interface? He's on an interface of being capable of achieving himself at a very high level and at the very same time of realizing that he has to let it go. He can do it. He can bring himself to perk right now, but he's got to leave that now and go live some more. Notice the quandary between self-attainment and life. This same thing poignantly is in, like in the Buddhist tradition, is when the Buddha comes to enlightenment, after he sits under the four trees, the last tree is the Bodhi tree, each of four trees for 7 days, and goes through that 28-day cycle, and comes to enlightenment, what is the second moment that occurs in the Buddha? But the thought, how could I teach this to someone else? Notice immediately on attaining enlightenment is the life process. Well, how could I teach this to someone else? And he's thinking about this. Well, no, it's impossible. It's not possible to teach this to someone else. And in the Buddhist wisdom story about this, just as he's in that state of mind, that is not possible to teach someone else, two wandering businessmen or traveling businessmen who have been discussing life and everything with each other find this mendicant, the Buddha, and they ask him to tell them something that will help them in their life. Just at that moment, life brings... Just as you decide, well, I've done it, but I can't help anybody else, someone comes and says, could you give me a clue? I'm having a really tough time. And notice how the mystery of life continues, even for someone who has attained enlightenment. It's like that kind of story. So Rilke is in that kind of a quandary, that kind of a sense. This is the 11th sonnet to Orpheus. Search the heavens. Looking at star constellations. Search the heavens. Is no horseman reckoned there in the starry outline? For we share much with that proud earth, and with a second driving, curbing, whom it has to bear. Is not this first hunted and then broken, just the nature of the course we run, turf and turning, pressure, nothing spoken, new horizons, and the two are one. Are they, though? Or are they never able both to choose the way they both pursue, severingly unlike our field and table? Even those uniting stars beguile. Still, it gladdens and suffices too to believe the symbol for a while. I'll give you Young's translation of that. Look at the stars. Is there no constellation called Horseman? Sagittarius. For the animal's earth pride is strangely ingrained in us, so is the human will to control, guide, be carried. Isn't this chasing and being broken in part of the sinewy nature of things? The trail and the turnoff, touch as understanding, fresh distances, and rider and horse are one. But are they? Does either of them want the path that they travel together? Pasture and table already drawn them apart? Even that union in the stars is deceptive. Still, let's be glad to believe in that figure for a while now. That's enough. You see the exquisiteness of Rilke? And then, not to let it drag on, because we have a couple of mass to do, I want to give you the first sonnet to Orpheus of the second part. Give you Leishman's first, and then I'll give you Wood's translation. In other words, after he had finished the 36 sonnets to Orpheus, a second pulse came. The first sequence of the sonnets to Orpheus is like that moment of enlightenment. The second part is like one is still here, one is still alive, it's still continuing. Isn't that amazing? So here's the first sonnet to Orpheus from the second part, which would be in sequence the 37th in the sonnets to Orpheus. Leishman's translation. Breathing. Invisible poem. That great world space at each inhalation exchanged for this human existence. Counterweight of my rhythmical realization. Single wavelet whose slowly gathering sea am I. You of all possible seas, most frugal and lowly, space laid by. Of all those places in space, how many a one has been within me already? Many a wind seems like a sun. Do you know me, air, still full of my dwelling places? You, the one-time smooth-skinned rondure and leaf of my phrases? In other words, in that tranquility, in that pause between breathing in and breathing out, no matter how spectacular that is, there is still the exhalation. That air was in you when you were enlightened, now it's out here. How about that? Woods translates it this way. Can you see? It's an incredible mystical moment. Breathing. You invisible poem, world space incessantly having its pure traffic with our own being, counterweight system in which I rhythmically occur, lone wave whose gradual sea I am, you sparsest of possible seas making room. How many places in space have already been inside me. Many a wind is like a sun to me. Do you know me, air? You full of places that once were mine? You, once the smooth rind, the roundness and leaf of my speech. What's the most forceful compositional exhalation? Speaking. Speaking in mystical poetry. And as one does so, the very air that was the life of one is now out here in this space, in the world, going. Who knows where, you see. It's a peculiar state of mind. It's the state of mind in between art and history. It's the state of mind of having come to build the ark of the self and now realizing it's got to float. It's got to go out there into the world. That's what it was made for. Not just for you to have. You made a self, you achieved your own person, not to have it, but as a vehicle now to carry you on this great adventure across the ocean of time. Well, you never even knew that that was in store. Can you see the quandary, the triumph curling into this kind of incredible realization? Oh, that's what it's all for. I never knew. Well, that's the feeling tone that's there, and that's what we need to be conscious of at this particular juncture in our education, that those kinds of moments exist. Only the conscientious heart is really capable of taking such moments seriously. The mind left to itself will simply make a beautiful idea out of it and say, well, that's a very interesting idea. It's what happens to myself in time, or something like that. Or one gets very classical and quotes Plato from the Timaeus and says, well, time is the moving image of eternity. But you see, the formulation, the equations like that are true, but what does that mean to you when you're doing it? And the heart energy says, we better gird ourselves up because we're in for a blow. The wind is rising in the tower, says the Chinese. Meaning, we thought we had gotten somewhere, we worked damn hard to get there, now we find that we didn't get anywhere particular, but we got to the vehicle that now has to go somewhere. The traditional way that the Buddha used to speak about the self is that don't worry about the self. Worry about getting to the other shore. It's getting to the other shore that is the real problem and not the self. And misunderstood through many misinterpretations of saying, well, the Buddha says that there's no self. Well, he means there's no self worth worrying about. That's not the problem. The problem is the other shore. That's a problem worth worrying, because that is a very big problem. So next week, we'll shove off the shore of the self and head out into the deep unknown. As Melville says at the end of the beginning of Moby Dick, the first chapter, he says upon that moment that he suddenly had a vision of angels in heaven, two by two, all with their hands in big jars full of spermaceti, in pairs going off into the infinite paradise. And there, somewhere in the vast distance, like a hooded phantom facing at his own destiny, like a snow hill in the air.
I'll make you a copy in just a minute. We're going to do our math in a minute. Just let them all down. We're going to do our math.
I didn't hear what your introduction was to Matt, but you go there.
I said, this is my second Matt. I made another Matt, the same title, but made it when I was 3 years old.
Yeah. From here, the bowl hit the eyes halfway, and it looks like it's looking down. That mask is the role of eroding facade?
Yeah. But this is contemporary, and the one I made before.
But you remembered the one at age three, which is pretty young.
No, it wasn't a memory.
No.
I made it as a child.
Oh, you made it as a child with him at age three.
As I would have made it at age three.
I see. The nose is two little holes, or are they painted black paint?
No, they're just two little, one-hole punch nostrils.
I see. Punch nostrils.
That's the only way I could cut them out.
Okay. In other words, the face has a two-dimensional plane-like quality, which is wrapped. It's a plane that's wrapped around the face, rather than being a three-dimensional face.
Maybe it's just from knowing you for a few years, but I really see a part of your personality in that mask. When you made the facial when you drew out the facial parts, were you looking at yourself at the time? Or
oh no. No, just trying to get the eyes and mouth to fit where mine would be.
I don't know how to describe it, but
no.
Not that that's you, but it's just that I see personality in that, which I didn't in some of the other ones. I can really see that as a mask.
It's eroding, whatever it is.
I see a lot of wisdom in the thing. And acceptance.
I can't think really of humbling, but of strength.
Yeah. Pardon?
But of strength there. Strength even though paddled and accompanied.
Yes,
Chris, can you put the mask on and let Molly see it on someone else for just a second? And then let Sina continue talking about it. She seems strength there, Mom.
Yeah, that's a lot of strength, past and future. That's my feeling about it. That it would be, what did you say? I keep saying crumbling. It is deterioration.
Eroding.
Eroding is a movement. It's an ongoing, and then I see ongoing strength there.
Erosion is a particular kind of an adjective applied to landscape. A landscape erodes.
Mm-hmm.
This is a facial landscape which is eroding. Yeah. And you have earth and water colors there, except for the pink, which is a blossom color. Yeah, it's too bad. Oh, here.
No, I was just gonna get it off the
scotch tape?
No, that black bowl background.
Yeah. Here's some scotch tape. Maybe you can put it against the white background.
I don't want to rest
it
on.
Oh, it's not on that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yes, that'll do.
I don't see it so much as erosion as turmoil. And the thing that strikes me is the eye, the shape of the eyes and the mouth. The shape of the mouth particularly.
to if you talk about that stuff?
As I said, the erosion is of the fog. And shape of the eyes and the mouth were made in that sort of slanting fashion to carry through what my intention was.
You think it's falling off?
Yeah.
I had a sort of similar reaction to Chris. I think that it's the mouth, the shape of the mouth that's interesting to me. And the way I see it sort of as a suckling phase, suckling phase. And it's sort of an kind of expression, sort of a, I suck from oil, or a what am I getting into, or something. And so I see it as coming into manifestation, like coming into another life, and certainly a sense of woe about that, as it takes in the nourishment to embody itself. So in a way, it's like, it's taking on upon itself a facade. It's like it's eroding out of reality into manifestation. So, in a sense, I think about it when I see the map without anybody behind it now, when somebody is behind the map and I see the eyes that do show through prominently in the mouth, then I don't get that so much.
It's interesting that to me the erosion title is sort of a negative thing. To me, the colors are so bright, and the shape of the colors, and the flowing of the colors, to me, it's more birth than erosion.
The colors flow.
Well,
but
it's not even just a simple emergence of something that's predestined or something that's there. To me, if a mass erodes, you think you're going to see another mass behind it. You don't. You see all this living color and swirl and all that. And
there's a living swirl.
Yeah.
Right. It's like if you put an oil slick on top of water and you move it, it takes that kind of a swirl motion.
Mm-hmm.
Notice that the swirl is an erosion of a geometric pattern, like a rigid parfait pattern. This would be an erosion from that.
Mm-hmm.
But contrary to that, this is achieving more life than what had been there before. So it's an erosion in one sense, it's an evolution in another sense. And what gives it a weight towards the evolution rather than just the erosion? Erosion is a static land quality, evolution is a liquid flow quality, is the movement, the shapes of the eyes and the mouth. If the mouth were a geometric circle, it would be more in tune with the erosion theme. But the fact that it's an expressive mouth, uttering sound, uttering words, it's more a flow towards something new than an erosion of something old.
Okay, months, I guess it's been more than a month. I have had so much tension building up to the making of this mask.
Yeah.
I just felt at times I was falling apart. Just the attention was so
yeah.
And the minute this mask was finished, it was just like all the tension dropped away.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. Such an interesting experience.
Yeah.
So what?
I know.
It's really interesting. I can't really fully explain it, but
it did happen.
I had an incredible recognition during this time. I think giving birth to that recognition is the thing that's really been happening.
Yeah, the Greek term for that is catharsis, purification.
Yeah, it seems to be crying out. Maybe you got a chance to cry out for this.
That's possible.
It's a chance to see the bones behind the structures of faith, like the facade, the facial facade. There's the white there. It's like the skull. It's like a you know, a removal and you're conscious to enough to, you know, to cast another face upon that if you choose to.
Yeah, and but also it's interesting, Molly said a 3-year-old, but, you know, most of you have had experience with raising children. You know that at the age of 4, children become afraid of the dark for a little while. They go through that phase. It happens for a couple of weeks or a month or so, like that. And all of a sudden, they can't go to sleep because they're going to get me. It's that kind of expression that you see on their faces. That's the expression of someone, oh, I can't go to sleep. Can't go to sleep now. We better turn some lights on. Look under the bed. Check the closet. I know they're there, and they're going to get me. It's that kind of a thing. But from the inside. From the inside. They're not out there. That's why they're not out there, is because they're in here. See? And I know that. But the fact is, as soon as this is made, whatever was covering this that allowed them to hide in here, there's no place for them to hide now, so they're in there. They're in the they're in the mat, see.
And it's round like a baby head.
It is round like a child's head, yeah. They're like that. And the child about that age, the head is bigger than the rest of the body.
Round,
you know, like those Peanuts characters that have the big head. Children about that age are like that. Yeah. They're just like that. So your intuition about the age thing is a very key part of the catharsis. You told yourself the truth, because at this stage you're not going to lie to yourself at all. And the truth was that this is a young perspective of you, which is there.
But something that has carried forward.
Yeah. Yeah. It pays to check. Have we one more minute?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's do this second minute. If we can leave yours here, I think Sylvie had to go to San Francisco for her older daughter, and we'll take them next week and let her make some photos of it, okay? Can we do that? I'll take good care of it. Okay.
Well, I should explain that I never envisioned this mask with cutouts, you know, rooms for eyes and nose and mouth. I call this mask Madame Beverly Hills Blitz. It is a mask I feel I consciously assume. What I feel is interesting about it is even when I have occasion to tell people, I mean, I am not the way I look to be, and I'm thinking of a couple of what you might call business situations, I feel that it's falling on deaf ears. And, you know, they assume me to be like this and to be, you know, a quaint little person who majored in French lit and went to a convent school and is sort of glistening out. And when I, you know, even, as I say, very boldly say, I'm not the way I appear, you'll find that I'm very businesslike, and I expect this at this point in time, that, and the other thing, and everything. It's simply disregarded, and therefore I assume, looking like this, I go into what I call my chief executive officer, brass knuckles, Republican mode, and proceed to do the follow-up and pick these pieces up and carry the project through to a satisfactory conclusion. In other words, I proceed to act in an administrative and business-like manner that should have been assumed by the other party. And I used to think, you know, like, obviously, I'm not explaining this correctly to people. I don't know how I can look to explain it to them. But I've come to realize that it really doesn't matter what I look like or what I say, that the chances are people are just not listening to me or to anyone in particular. So that's my confusion about it.
Yeah, their inattentiveness is not personal.
That, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just endemic in the way that they are.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I, as I say, looking like this, I proceed to go into another mode of behavior, which is...
If you respond to someone in like kind, that's the essence of absurd theater, is to respond to someone being in the same mode of their inattentiveness. Samuel Beckett does that better than anyone. Yeah. And after a while, you can see that the whole thing is absurd, but it's true. The absurd is not untrue. It's just, unfortunately, the condition that very often we have to exist in.
Yeah.
So, go ahead, yeah.
I was just going to say, just an observation of you not looking through that mask and holding it up there reminds me of the ventriloquist.
Yeah.
And people relating to this dummy character that, you know, that someone's...
Yeah, meet the dummy. Meet the dummy.
Yeah, meet the dummy from the side.
You
want
to talk
here,
to the dummy?
You know? And you were talking and your hand is kind of moving, you know, giving voice to, you know, what you're holding, and that was, you know, that conveyed that, you know, that feeling very well. Who you're trying to say, you know, this is not me here, this is the dummy here, you know, and I need to project this to people to, you know, to let me into their, you know, clicks momentarily, you know, to break the ice or so before we get down to business. And okay, now, you know, let's put the dummy away and be personable.
I knew an ex-chorus girl who had become very great astrologer and a tremendously intelligent woman. And she suffered from that kind of a situation. She got one of these dolls that had the large breasts and everything and used to leave that on her bed. And whenever she had these particularly tough times, she would take somebody in there and say, the doll is on the bed. You have to really draw the line sometimes and say, look, that's the edge right there. This is a fan, is it not?
No, it's, I think these are what shirts are put around.
Oh.
Laundry, and then it's put on a...
Popsicle stick. Mm. Popsicle sticks and stuffed shirt. It's a wonderful image, isn't it?
I'm struck by the fact that you made it square, and that this is a force. We're very conventional kind of thing.
As one sees the light through it, then there's the possible fix, make a cross right at the throat.
Oh. Yeah. Step back for a second and let down and see that.
Yeah. Oh, indeed, yeah. I didn't like that.
Very good. Very good. Right at the throat chakra. Yeah. And that would be popsicle stick.
Also, I'm struck by the fact that you cut it off so at the top, so you're really not showing your cranium.
No, I'm not.
Your brains up there are sort of chopped, cut off, sliced off.
Well, this was,
actually,
I was hoping to do like black yarn with a streak of gray to do my hair, and my neighbor, who was my best step to help me on that, didn't have anything.
But I meant that it is out of proportion. proportion that you have more forehead than the mass.
That really, really looks like snake skin. I mean, I thought that was, that's what it was, you know, imitation snake skin.
Right, and snake skin is something which would be shredded, shedded and shredded. Yeah.
And I think, well, shaman, fairly ill shaman.
Isn't there one of those?
I think there's one of those.
A few crystals.